طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This is your host, John Roberts. Well, the Israeli lobby is at it again with their under-the-radar shenanigans. When they cannot win legislative battles fighting out in the open, they resort to sneak attacks. Having failed to pass their unconstitutional anti-BDS legislation in the open, they are working to have it surreptitiously added to the congressional omnibus spending bill, where it will get no debate. I'm going to read from the ACLU publication outlining the issue. Quote, according to recent reports, congressional leaders from both sides of the aisle are planning to sneak a bill criminalizing politically motivated boycotts of Israel into the end-of-the-year omnibus spending bill. The bill's original sponsor, Senator Ben Cardin, is pushing Democratic leadership to include this bill, which has not moved forward thus far, primarily because it violates the First Amendment. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi are reportedly leaning towards slipping the text into the spending bill, which needs to pass for the government to stay open. The ACLU has long opposed the Israel Anti-Boycott Act through its multiple iterations because the bill would make it a crime to participate in political boycotts protected by the First Amendment. Now the bill's sponsors are attempting to avoid public scrutiny by including the bill's unconstitutional criminal penalties in must-pass legislation scheduled for a vote just days before Congress adjourns, likely because it will be harder to pass in the new Congress. Earlier versions of the Israeli Anti-Boycott Act would have made it a crime, possibly even subject to jail time, for American companies to participate in political boycotts aimed at Israel and its settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories when those boycotts were called for by international governmental organizations like the United Nations. The same went for boycotts targeting any country that is friendly to the United States, if the boycott was not sanctioned by the United States. The ACLU has seen an updated version being considered for inclusion in the spending bill. While Capitol Hill offices claim the First Amendment concerns have been resolved and potential jail time has indeed been eliminated as a possible punishment, the bill actually does nothing to cure its First Amendment problems. Furthermore, knowingly violating the bill could result in criminal financial penalties of up to $1 million. Were this legislation to pass, federal officials would have a new weapon at their disposal to chill and suppress speech that they find objectionable or politically unpopular. Consider, for example, if the United Nations advocated boycotting Saudi Arabia in response to the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, the Washington Post journalist, or Russia in response to its alleged election interference around the world. That would mean American companies, small business owners, and even nonprofits, potentially some religious organizations, and people acting on their behalf in support of the boycott could be subject to criminal penalties. This is a full-scale attack on Americans' First Amendment freedoms. Political boycotts, including boycotts of foreign countries, have played a pivotal role in this nation's history, from the boycotts of British goods during the American Revolution, to the Montgomery bus boycott, to the campaign to divest from apartheid South Africa, and in NAACP versus Claiborne Hardware, the Supreme Court made clear that the First Amendment protects the right to participate in political boycotts. Although the bill states that nothing in the act shall be construed to diminish or infringe upon any other right protected under the Constitution of the United States, such hollow assurances do not undo its core purpose of penalizing First Amendment activities and silencing speech. Members of Congress who support this bill should take note of the fact that just this year, two federal courts blocked the state laws seeking to suppress boycotts of Israel. Those laws, like many copycats around the country, required state contractors to certify that they are not participating in boycotts of Israel as a condition of doing business with the state. The courts agreed with the ACLU that these anti-boycott laws violate Americans' First Amendment rights. The Israel Anti-Boycott Act is another page from the same unconstitutional playbook. It is clear why congressional leaders fear an open debate on this legislation. Restricting Americans' freedom of expression is rarely a popular policy. But that is no excuse for smuggling controversial new crimes into last-minute appropriations packages. If the First Amendment means anything, it's that the government cannot suppress political expression it does not like. Whatever their views on the Israel-Palestine conflict, members of Congress should oppose any effort to include this unconstitutional law within the omnibus spending bill. Americans' First Amendment rights are at stake. That was an analysis of the federal anti-boycott legislation published by the American Civil Liberties Union. However, Constitution be damned, the Israeli lobby will force the legislation under the radar come hell or high water. This needs to be stopped. Please call your congressional representatives and senators and urge them to defeat this sneak attack. And now on to our feature presentation, which this morning is two speeches delivered at the recent conference of the Jerusalem Fund at the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C. First, you will hear Josh Rubner, Policy Director at the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, followed by Palestinian civil rights attorney, practicing in New York, Lamis Deek. First, Josh Rubner.
I'd like to thank the Palestine Center for inviting me to speak here this morning. Palestinian Rights is a national coalition of more than 300 organizations across the country, including the Palestine Center as one of our longtime members and supporting organizations, so it's always good to be back here. Today we're convening this annual conference of the Palestine Center in the midst of what could be argued is an unprecedented crackdown and repression by the United States against the Palestinian people and against their legitimate rights. We see this take a myriad number of forms, from the cuts to UNRWA to the ending of bilateral, quote-unquote, humanitarian assistance from USAID, to the closure of the PLO office in Washington, D.C., to the transfer of the U.S. Embassy to Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, and to the dissolution of the U.S. Consulate General in Jerusalem, which is actually, I believe, one of, if not the most significant, of these Trump administration efforts to repress the Palestinian people, even though in many respects has gotten the least attention of the Trump administration's many moves to repress the Palestinian people. And the reason why I believe that's the case is because it marks a very significant policy shift in the way that the United States thinks about its relationships with the Palestinian people. The U.S. Consul General actually predates the establishment of the State of Israel by some 80 years and actually predates the establishment of the modern Zionist movement by 20 years. And it's an institution which has always operated separately and independently from the U.S. Embassy to Tel Aviv to be the reporting channel to listen to the interests of the Palestinian people and report that directly back to Washington, D.C. without the interference of the embassy in Washington. And so for the Trump administration to subsume the consul general within this new U.S. embassy in Jerusalem and to create within the U.S. embassy to Israel an office for Palestinian affairs, despite Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announcing that this does not affect any so-called permanent status negotiations or positions of the United States, it actually does, because the United States is now articulating that it sees its relationship to the Palestinian people as officially a subset of its relation to Israel. So why is the Trump administration engaging in all of these steps to repress the Palestinian people? In my estimation, it's an attempt, a very heavy-handed attempt, to weaken and soften the Palestinian leadership in an attempt to get it to capitulate to what Trump has euphemistically referred to as the, quote, deal of the century, his plan to establish a permanent Israeli-Palestinian peace. Now, it should be noted from the leaks and the bits of information about this so-called deal of the century, which have trickled out over the past year or so, that it does differ in some details from previous U.S. quote-unquote peace plans, but that it actually does not fundamentally differ in substance from previous offers made to the Palestinian people under the Clinton administration, under the George W. Bush administration, under the Barack Obama administration, which were, of course, all plans pre-coordinated and preconceived between Israel and the United States in an attempt to impose it on the Palestinian people. So under this plan, the quote-unquote state-minus aspects of the so-called Palestinian state that would arise are more explicit, more blatant than under previous plans. Israel might annex more of the West Bank under this plan than under previous plans, but in substance, it does not differ fundamentally from previous plans. The plan always was for a state minus. The plan always was for the Palestinian entity not to be a sovereign state, not to have an army, not to have an independent foreign policy, not to have any control over its borders, its airspace, its sea lanes. This was always the plan. The Trump administration has just made that plan much more explicit. And so in addition to the repression that we're seeing the Trump administration engage in toward the Palestinian people in an attempt to get them to capitulate to U.S. and Israeli demands, we're also seeing intense repression facing people who advocate for Palestinian rights within the United States and indeed across the globe. We're seeing this through the Trump administration in the appointment of Kenneth Marcus to be the Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights within the Department of Education. This is the job within the Department of Education that looks into allegations of discrimination and bigotry towards students on college campuses. And Ken Marcus comes to this position from a Zionist organization whose primary and sole mission was to file false allegations of anti-Semitism against student organizers for Palestinian rights on campus. In all five or six of the investigations that Kenneth Marcus either filed or conspired to help file, the Department of Education threw out these charges as being baseless and said that advocating for Palestinian rights constitutes legitimate political expression on campus, even if people are uncomfortable with it. What Kenneth Marcus has failed to do from the outside, he has been brought into the government by the Trump administration to now accomplish from within. And so already, he was just confirmed a few months ago, already He has reopened closed cases into alleged acts of anti-Semitism. And he has unilaterally decided that he is going to impose this redefinition of what constitutes anti-Semitism to include legitimate political criticisms of Israel within the orbit of that definition. So that the force of the federal government will now come down on student organizers for Palestinian rights who are advocating successfully on their campuses to pass boycott and divestment resolutions and to label them anti-Semitic for doing so. This attempt to repress coming from within the Trump administration is coupled with attempts coming from within Congress to repress on many different levels. And what I'd like to do is to point your attention to three pieces of outstanding legislation, which may or may not get debated and voted on in the three remaining weeks we have left in this congressional session. Number one is something called the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act. This is a bill that would take what Kenneth Marcus is doing within the Department of Education and mandate that the Department of Education use this flawed definition of anti-Jewish bigotry as its standard for adjudicating whether there is bigotry on college campuses. Basically, it would be enshrining in law what Ken Marcus is already doing through the Department of Education. Number two, I'd like to draw your attention to something called the Combating BDS Act, which is being pushed by Senator Marco Rubio in the Senate. This is a bill that aims to encourage states and localities to pass the exact same types of laws which have been declared unconstitutional by two federal district judges that, in essence, punish people by refusing them contracts with the state for supporting boycotts for Palestinian rights. And the third and most draconian of the bills being debated in Congress relating to the repression of activism and advocacy for Palestinian rights is the Israel Anti-Boycott Act. This bill not only seeks to punish and harm people who advocate for Palestinian rights, but actually to throw them into jail for up to 20 years. This legislation states that if you provide information to, or if you advance an international organization's call to boycott Israel or even Israeli settlement products, if you do this, you are liable to criminal penalties of up to $1 million and 20 years in prison. With this amount of outright repression being openly and proudly debated by some in Congress, one might take it as a sign that Israel and its supporters are stronger than ever in this country. But I believe that the reverse is actually true, because all of this repression is not a sign of strength. You don't need to engage in repression if you think that you are winning. You engage in efforts to repress and to silence because you are on the losing side of history. And so I view this as an indication that we collectively are on the right track in advancing Palestinian rights in this country. Now, I would be a very bad organizer if I was all doom and gloom and did not leave you with at least a grain of hope. But I actually see much more than a grain of hope, not on the long-term horizon, but on the short-term horizon. And let me tell you why I think that the repression of the Trump administration, of Congress, of Israel is failing in three different reasons. Number one, this direct Trump administration effort to repress the Palestinian people in order to get them to try to capitulate to U.S.-Israeli demands has backfired. Even the compliance Palestinian Authority, which has been so quick to enter into and continue to perpetuate the charade of negotiations for 25 years. Even this attempt to crack down on the PA and to pressure it has backfired, with the positions taken by the Trump administration being so extreme that PA President Mahmoud Abbas has cut off all contact with the administration, and the feeling is mutual. No longer do we have a fig leaf of a dialogue. No longer do we have the fig leaf of Israelis and Palestinians sitting down together around the negotiating table. But we have a clear scenario in which it is the United States and Israel which is attempting to dominate and dictate a one-sided outcome, something which was already there, but it's just much more obvious now to everyone that this is the case. Number two, the attempts to repress people who are engaged in advocacy for Palestinian rights in the United States has also backfired tremendously. And even though you now have states, about 25 in number, which have passed laws to punish people who support boycotting for Palestinian rights, the negative ramifications and the pushback for engaging in this type of blatant behavior to silence our First Amendment right to engage in boycotts has been tremendous. So the fact that you have these laws introduced and passed at the state level and attempts to do so at the federal level has brought the American Civil Liberties Union onto our side, clearly defending our right to engage in this type of advocacy and these types of boycotts. And in fact, as I alluded to earlier, the ACLU, which is arguably one of the most influential civil society organizations in the entire country, has filed and successfully won 2 court cases challenging laws that have attempted to punish people who support boycotting for Palestinian rights. And in both cases, the federal district judges have, for the first time, set a precedent that, yes, indeed, we have a constitutional First Amendment protected right to engage in boycotts for Palestinian rights. And we also see that this repression at the congressional level has mobilized the ACLU to oppose all 3 bills which I alluded to earlier, placing us and the ACLU in one corner and Israel and its supporters in the opposite side, and that's absolutely a fight that I want to have, and I think that we can win. Number 3. The identification of the Trump administration, not only with Israel, but with the extreme right annexationist apartheid impulses of the most right-wing government in the history of Israel, has not only enabled and continued a process of creating a partisan divide on this issue, but it has established a firm partisan divide. Republicans are now the party of Israel, and Democrats are the ones who are questioning that relationship, and in many cases, upending it. And so we heard a little bit about the results of the midterms, and we can look to innumerable public opinion polls to affirm this yawning chasm between the base of the Democratic Party and the base of the Republican Party. We see that there are now 31 Democratic members of Congress who are supporting, in this current congressional session, the first ever bill to advocate for Palestinian rights, unabashedly, without any mention of Israel's quote-unquote security. To say that abusing, interrogating, and in some cases torturing Palestinian children through Israel's military detention system is wrong, immoral, and no U.S. aid should be used for that purpose. We have a representative-elect, Rashida Tlaib, who not only supports a one-state resolution, but also supports sanctioning Israel until it ends its human rights abuses of the Palestinian people. And just the other day, we had another representative-elect, Ilhan Omar, from Minnesota, not only say that she supports our right to engage in boycott for Palestinian rights, but supports BDS. These type of developments were unimaginable in Congress even a year ago. And so I believe that if we work smart and if we work hard over the next 2 years and continue to seed this transformation that is beginning to manifest itself at the grassroots of the Democratic Party and now up to Congress, we will be in a position to create the fundamental transformation that we need to achieve Palestinian rights in 2020. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Josh. I believe we have Lamis on Skype. All right, that'll be our next speaker.
So thank you, Mohammed, and the Jerusalem Fund for accommodating the Skype intervention. I extend my apologies to everybody. I really wish I could be with you. And I want to give a special shout out to the woman I had hoped to see, Samira Saoud. Thank you for all of your work and for this event. Suhair as well. It's good to see you. I could see you from here. I'd like to begin my portion by first and foremost, because I think it's always important for us to begin at the beginning, which is our people in Palestine and honoring our fallen heroes in Gaza, especially those who we lost over this weekend, and who in their sacrifice and in their act of what I think is the purest form of love, a not self-interested love, gave their lives to protect the 2 million people in Gaza who are imprisoned by Israel and whom without the resistance are but 2 million hostages and walking targets of the Israeli colonizing project for ethnic cleansing, in particular the sacrifice of Sheikh Nuruddin Baraki, Mustafa Ode, and Mohammed al-Tatari, which brought to Gaza and Palestine a tremendous victory by their discovery of an Israeli military cache inside of Gaza, which preempted a broader massacre, saved countless Palestinian lives, and materially protected the global struggle for peace. The global struggle for peace at which Palestine is most centrally situated and for which Palestine is best poised to push forward. BDS is our only form of indirect accountability, and the Palestinian resistance is the only form of direct accountability and preemption of Israeli violence that Palestinians have. And so it is my hope that we normalize and elevate the Palestinian resistance. Now, much like we saw stem from the attacks and violence and massacres in Gaza, especially the latest, what we see, as Josh touched upon, in the expanding circumference of Zionist and Israeli repression and violence, even in the U.S., is an exposure of Israeli weakness, an exposure of Israeli arrogance, in which is an opportunity, and of course, an exposure of their desperation. I'll address the dangerous repression that has plagued first and above all Palestinians, Arabs, and Muslims in the United States, and which has had consequences far graver than what we see in the academy. Now, I personally join you as a member of an organization, perhaps one of the only organizations in the U.S. that has endured and fully and unequivocally defeated some of the most concentrated liquidation and counterintelligence efforts of Zionists and U.S. forces of repression. I myself was a primary target of this operation, which we deduced over a period of years, and which began on the same day that the Mavi Marmara was raided and continued until at least 2015. Palestinian repression of Palestinians in the U.S. did not begin after 9/11, but was a part of U.S. policy for decades. In fact, Nixon's Operation Boulder of the 70s and the Supreme Court's ruling related to this, that U.S. executive agencies are permitted to implement foreign policy by targeting dual nationals inside the borders of the United States is piece and parcel and the original codification of the right to repress Palestinians and Palestinian speech. So what Josh was talking about is actually a reversal of the court's policy and pre-existing policies, and taken in context is actually a huge victory. Now, post 9/11, as many of you know, Palestinians, Palestinian organizations, Palestinian communities were the first and biggest target of the Patriot Act and its execution throughout the United States. I was practicing at the time, and I had already come to defending the Palestinian community even before I graduated law school. And so what we were watching were surreal, and I mean this with no exaggeration, surreal levels of very militant, made-for-TV type of surveillance. And case after case that appeared before the courts or in the news, framed as some big, terrorist plot, were manufactured cases that had been begun or were developed and prosecuted at the behest of and in coordination with Israeli and Zionist operatives and think tanks right there in D.C. And so it was in these cases that we first saw, right? We have to understand how this is all tied. And it was in these cases that we first saw the actual criminalization of speech on Palestine, even before it had reached the legislative effect. It was in the executive agencies, both state and federal, meant not just to chill speech on Palestine, but to terrorize and destroy entire communities in the U.S. and to break their relationship with international networks in support of Palestine. And it should have been, it should have been scary at the time, but it got worse. Around the same time, the NYPD, in coordination with the CIA, which is not allowed to operate inside U.S. borders, though I've caught them doing that several times, in coordination with the CIA and in coordination with Israel, had set up a secret, illegal unit operating in New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and likely elsewhere, that was modeled precisely on the Israeli network and surveillance and control practices and policies used in the West Bank. So we had inside the United States a mechanism modeled and coordinated with the Zionist entities' practices and policies of controlling, killing, and colonizing people. And this was implemented in the United States. Now, their tactics were so thuggish and so brazen and so arrogant that it was because of their infiltration of our organization with the exposure and our ability to decode what they were really doing that not only led to the dismantlement, for the most part, of this unit, but even caused and birthed and really succeeded in removing, the sacred at that time police commissioner Ray Kelly from his post. And so our, ragtag operation, which had a budget of anywhere between $1,000 and $3,000 each year, defeated a multi-million dollar NYPD project with the might of Israel behind it. And that is a tremendous, tremendous victory. Now, our organization was, let me start by saying this. I use this as an example, and I've got countless more perhaps that are better, but I'm here and I'm trying to keep it short. What I want us to take away from what Josh said and what I'm trying to convey to you are a few points. Number one, we cannot and we must make sure that we study and understand the detailed minutiae of coordination between Israel, the United States, and international forces of repression. An example. At the same moment that the Mavi Marmara was being raided, if everybody is familiar with the Mavi Marmara, May 2010, yes, I see heads shaking. At the same time that the Mavi Marmara was raided, Obama dispatched a team of lawyers and strategists from the United States to Israel to help save Israel from its legal and PR nightmare. On that very same day is when the NYPD sent two undercover agents to infiltrate our organization, which would, you know, really deplete our resources, though we defeated them, deplete our resources for approximately 5 years. On the anniversary of Nakba, almost every year for a number of years, various agencies, federal and state, would parade around a case that involved Palestinians, even when it was a blatant lie, and it often was a blatant lie, to the point that judges would tell the prosecutors, what does this have to do with terrorism? This is a regulatory case. This is a criminal case. But they would parade around so as to criminalize and deplete any resource they could for the commemoration of a Nakba. This is how detailed the coordination is between U.S., New York, state, federal agencies, and Israel. And it's important that we understand that there are no coincidences and that we prepare for this. Number two, we should know and always keep in mind whenever we're dealing with any case that no case that we're addressing, whether it's the legislation, the campus cases, the actual criminal prosecutions, nothing is isolated. This is internationally coordinated on every level. And so our approach to this must also be multi-layered and cross-continental. We saw that in the adoption of the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism in the UK. Not 2 weeks later, it's being used by the Department of Education here. And lastly, in all of this, even in the legislation, the infiltration that we endured, it's important that we are very attentive to what's happening, and know that if we employ just a modicum of creativity and courage, we have many gains to be made. I'm going to use myself as an example. There is nothing particular about me other than I work hard and I hope, inshallah, that I'm very committed to my people here and in Palestine. And in my practice, I've lost very few cases, alhamdulillah, but I take no credit for this, right? One case I lost and it was reversed on appeal, a political case. Another, we had to take the offer because it was too good to pass up. And the third was an issue of proportionality. But all of the cases that I've won in my practice, domestic or international strategizing, were always a result of mistakes made specifically because of government arrogance and their kind of getting high on their own power. And like Josh said, in this arrogance are critical opportunities for us to seize. Like I said, our organization, $3,000 at best, our annual budget, were able to take down and render useless a multi-million dollar project, right? And second, the wholesale unmasking, you know, of even the facade of diplomacy and the exposure of Israeli desperation, brute violence, brute repression, reveals a deep fear, which is, you know, and exposes them. And that's a lot easier to address and push back against than what we saw under the Obama administration, which is this invisible, omnipresent, you know, kind of unable, you can't convince people it's happening. And so for years, we were forced to work alone. And so it's an opportunity. And I bring that, you know, and I say this to Riyad Mansour's point as well. Yes, the nation state law is horrible. But in this is the only time that we are seeing the UN trying to hold Israel accountable for its finally honest admission that it is, in fact, an apartheid state. Some might think that the closure of the PLO mission is a problem. Maybe, maybe not. That's not my perspective, quite frankly, because what I see happening, and if you know the conditions of having the PLO mission in D.C., I mean, they were so horrible that the PLO mission was effectively made hostage, right? It was controlled by these awful conditions, which prevented the PLO mission and thereby the Palestinian Authority from protecting and acting in the interests not just of Palestinians in Palestine, but of Palestinians in the U.S. So what does this mean for us? This means for us the peeling of the facade of an administrative layer that serves our interests opens the door for us to become creative and to take up those spaces and to undo the failures of those conditions of having that mission here based in DC. So this is a tremendous opportunity. I do not see this as a defeat. And lastly, for some perspective, again, and to bring it back to Palestine, in 2014, the entire Palestinian gross domestic product, the entire Palestinian GDP was $7.5 billion. In that same year, the Israeli military budget alone was $23.5 billion, excluding another $3.5 billion in direct military aid from the U.S. So $7.5 billion Palestinian GDP to $26-27 billion just on military spent on a starved, besieged, Bantustanized, if that's a word, occupation, and still the resistance in Palestine, the resistance in Gaza, not only defeated them strategically and militarily, but politically and psychologically won hearts of the masses across the world. And if they are able to do this, we are capable of so much more. All we need is some courage, some commitment, and some elbow grease, right? No cause and no case has ever been won by the timid. And in closing, to bring it back to the Great Return March, you know, it is unfortunately a failure of our negotiators that for 70 years we have left the Palestinian right to return as a footnote, right? And in post-Oslo, having it as that footnote is what has really defeated, you know, strategic gains for Palestinian return and liberation. What we saw the Great Return March do just in the past 5 months was more productive and more materially beneficial to Palestinian return. And again, I say in real, direct, material ways, therefore, more beneficial to the struggle for global and regional peace and stability than people in D.C. and London and Ramallah have been able to do for 50 years.
You have been listening to Josh Rubner and Lamas Deek speaking together on a forum at the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.